Good evening, ladies. My name is Lorna, and I'm an alcoholic. And let me remember my manners. And the first thing to do is to thank the committee so much for inviting me here. And I know that you have a choice of many speakers, so it's a great privilege to be asked. And I often think, when I begin to speak, especially somewhere like here, that when I open my mouth, everyone's scrambling, looking at the program and saying, it says that she's from New York. Is that a New York accent? And I often say, no, it's not. It's a West Texas accent. But now I don't really want to say West Texas anymore for other reasons. When I first used to speak, when I finished speaking, I used to think and I used to say to myself, good God, the next time I speak, I must get my story straight. And, you know, there's no getting it straight because it changes all the time. I see it differently, I experience it differently, and with the years of sobriety, my story is constantly being revealed to me. And so there's absolutely no getting it straight. And I also used to think that I was here to somehow impart something to you. And I used to say, you know, I hope there's something I can say that's helpful to you, or that you get something out of what I have to say. And of course, now I realize that I'm not here at all to help you. I'm here because God thinks I need major league help. And I'm here to speak, to express myself, and to hear my own story, and maybe get something in. So it's, very often you'll hear people in AA, and some of us are guilty of the same thing, of saying, I don't go to meetings to hear about blah, or I don't go, and I don't want to hear a drunkologue, or I don't want to do this. But the whole thing is, maybe that person needs to say that, and maybe that person needs someone to hear. So whatever it is I'm spouting off this evening, thank you for being the receiver of whatever it is, and whatever is going to come out here. This is all a sort of a long preamble while my brain is scrambling to remember what we're going to talk about. But I think the thing for me to do is to be very classic, share my experience, strength, and hope. And the thing that really is a hallmark for my drinking is missing out on life and life passing me by. And you know, there were so many things that passed me by. I always say that I came of age in the 60s, and I was very friendly with, in fact, he was very sweet on me, Mick Jagger and all that crowd in England, and I've never been to a rock concert. You know, I just couldn't get it together. I just couldn't get it together to buy the ticket, and where do you go, and how's it done, and I'm fascinated with the dance, and I've never seen Nureyev or Fontaine dance. And I had lots of opportunity to do that. It was just like too much. It was all too much. And I just missed out on so much of life. And you know, I really do think the saddest sentence in the Bible is, and Jesus passed by. And I think, you know, supposing I arrived somewhere and someone said, Lorna, you should have been here 2 minutes ago. Jesus just passed by. I'd be like, oh, you know. But that really was it. Life passed me by. And at the I often describe the end of my drinking. I don't have any bell-clanging, great, thunderous bottom for my drinking. The end of my drinking, I often describe it as a plane coming into land without its landing gear. And I belly flopped and scraped along the runway for a long time. And finally, oh my God, who keeps adjusting this? Finally, the aircraft came to rest in a clump of trees or bushes, and the wings were torn off, and passengers are hanging out all over the place, and there's, you know, luggage and panties and bras hanging off bushes. It was just mucky, absolutely mucky, the end of my drinking. Is this all right? It sounds ever so echoey to me. Is it all right? Oh, good. Of course, I don't want you to miss a word. Part of that belly flopping into... is it gone again? It's all right. Part of that belly flopping into... I was in England. I worked with a British company. And I was in London for a gathering of my company and clients and things. Actually, to put this in context, I'm the first woman art auctioneer in America, and I was with Sotheby's, so I had a very highfalutin, public, prestigious, out there, rather nice job. And I'm in London for a gathering, and one evening there was a dinner dance at a very nice London hotel. And I'm all done up like a dog's dinner in a ball gown and everything. And these are my clients, these are the officers of my company, Lord and Lady Duwar Diddy, and all of the lot are there. And while they're dancing, I'm going from table to table, emptying their glass into mine. And I knew something told me my behavior doesn't quite match my outfit. It's not becoming that I'm doing this. But then the disease says, oh, what do you care? What do you think? They don't matter. They're square. It doesn't matter about them. And it's all right because it's you doing it. And so I came back. I was to leave England. It was July of 1976. And I was to leave England expressly to come back to America. I live in New York, to see the tall ships going up the Hudson. It was America's bicentennial, and there was a big celebration. Now, in the meantime, I had this boyfriend, and it was, you know, very often women come into the program on an emotional bottom, and that was certainly that was certainly true for me, and I was going through this very seedy relationship. I'd gone off to Paris to see him while I was in London. It sounds very glamorous, but believe me, it was not at all glamorous. And it had been a disaster, so I'd come back to London, and I was with my parents. And now I'm going off to London Airport to come back to America to see the tall ships. And I'm in the car, the car has come to pick me up to take me to London Airport. And my father is standing by the garden gate, waving me goodbye. And I am so caught up in self, in me, my pain, my relationship, my this, that, and the other. My father's waving to me, and I'm like, yeah, bye. And it was the last time I was to see him. And, you know, that really, they say that you will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I regret that. I regret it very much that I didn't have time to spend some time, of quality time with my parents, but it kind of me to not leave people like that again, to pay attention to relationships, to pay attention to the quality of the interaction in the moment. So anyway, I came back to America to see the tall ships, and I live on Manhattan Island. I live on an island which is surrounded with water. And I did not know how to get to a river. I didn't know how to get to the East River or to the Hudson River to see these ships. I mean, I could have walked out the front door, turned left or right, and walked, and I would have eventually hit a river. But it was all too much. And so I missed, the whole of America was celebrating, and I missed the entire thing, because I'm by myself in my apartment drinking. And you know, I was only 30 years old at that time, and it makes me wonder, how come I was so, I mean, I'm 28 years sober now, and I'm thinking, that part of my story is now being revealed to me, how isolated I was. How come I didn't have anyone else in my life? How come I didn't have a bunch of girlfriends to say, what are you doing at the bicentennial? Well, let's go together and see the tall ships. I had this big job. I knew loads of people. Why didn't I have anyone to be with? So anyway, that passed me by. And then as part of that belly flopping, you know, what had happened to me was I'd been married. And my husband had finally walked out the door. And I thought it was the most interesting thing he'd ever done. it really caught my attention, you know. And I was terribly unhappy about this. Very, very sad. And I wanted this man back. Desperately. One evening, I was in a sauna with a girlfriend of mine. We're sitting there naked in the sauna, and she says to me, you know, Lorna, last night I went to a meeting called Al-Anon. And she said, you know, all the women sounded just like you. So, I'm not one to let any grass grow under my feet, so and she talked to me about alcohol and alcoholism and how it looks and it's manifested, and the way she talked to me, I realized without a shadow of a doubt that my husband was an alcoholic. So, the very next night, I went to an Al-Anon meeting. And at this Al-Anon meeting, it was suggested that one go to open AA meetings. So, you know, I'm desperate to get him back, so I have no time to waste. So the very next, meanwhile, I'm going out with this other guy that I met in Paris, a tad unmanageable. But the very next night, I was to go to Bemelman's Bar in the Carlisle Hotel after work. And that is right opposite Sotheby's. And my favorite thing, it's on Madison Avenue, my favorite thing was to drink on an empty stomach. Yeah. I loved that first vodka. Vroom. You know, I mean, I don't want to sit there and eat the peanuts and chat. I want a drink. So, I was to do something that I did for many, many months. I went into this bar, and we were drinking, and I said to my friends, ooh, it's almost 7:30. I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll be back. So, I toddled on up the road to this meeting called Lenox Hill. And Lenox Hill in those days, it's still a meeting that exists today, but in those days it was very definitely the blue blood silk stocking meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the lawyers met there, the Park Avenue ladies, all the upper echelons of New York society, the drunks, were meeting at this place called Lenox Hill. So I checked it out. I checked that it was an open meeting and that people like me who were not alcoholic could go there and listen to these poor people. So I'm sitting there and the first chap gets up on the stage and much like I am now, and he says, good evening. He said, my name is Don and I'm an alcoholic. And I can remember thinking to myself, well, good God, we don't all want to know. surely there's some things you keep to yourself. I mean, really. But I was fascinated with this guy's story, riveted with this story. And I'm laughing, I'm rolling around in the aisles. I mean, I think it's hilarious. And then after him, two others got up and told equally as fascinating stories. So I went back to the bar after this meeting. And, you know, what did I know about anonymity? What did I know about the spiritual principles of anonymity? I mean, I thought it was a jolly good job that you were anonymous, and so you should be after all that you've gotten up to. But, I mean, it wasn't me. I didn't have to be anonymous. And I told them all at the bar, I said things like, well, you'd never guess who is an alcoholic. And I told them all details about their story, and I'm regaling them with these stories. Anyway, I kept on going to these open AA meetings. And I think that that is what qualifies me as an alcoholic. I don't think it's if you know how much one drinks, if one hides one drinks, how old one is when one starts to drink or one stops drinking, or anything to do with the drinking. I think if you come to these meetings and you enjoy hearing about people contemplating suicide, contemplating murder, vomiting on themselves or on their clients, you know, rolling on the bathroom floor, getting fired, their families kicking them out, and you find it fascinating, there's something the matter with you. There's something definitely not right. And not only do I find it interesting, I like to talk about it endlessly, and I like to go to coffee shops and talk about it, and I'm still, 28 years later, I'm still liking to talk about it. So there's definitely something amiss. Anyway, so I'm understanding AA. I'm going to these meetings to hear these stories because I thought I'd get the key to finding out how my husband ticked, and I would be able to lure him back so that I could torture him a little more. Now I'm back from the London trip. I'm still bouncing into AA, going to these meetings at odd times, and the lover comes back from Paris. And we agree to have brunch together. Now, I want to say to you that I want to tell you about this chap. I had decided I wanted to marry him, this Paris fellow. And The fact that he hadn't asked me didn't seem to pose any problem whatsoever. He hadn't even mentioned it, but I'd made up my mind that I was going to marry him. You know, I'm trying to get the husband back. I'm terribly unhappy about the husband, but I want to marry this other fellow. And the reason I wanted to marry him was that he had the one thing in the world I wanted. And it wasn't fine manners. It wasn't a great love of me. It was not a noble character. All those things which were important to me. Mm-mm. He had a maid. And I was desperate for the maid. I wanted someone to run my bath, to tell me it was time to take a bath. I wanted someone to wake me up. I wanted someone to lay my clothes out, to brush my hair, to put my food on the table. It was all getting too much for me, just too much. And, you know, in his house, you would sit down in a chair, and next to every chair you sat down in, there'd be a little table. And on that table would be a silver a container for loose cigarettes, a lighter, and an ashtray. And I was always looking for one or all three of those things. So I just was enamored by the maid. And I always say, you know, I allowed this fellow to touch the sacred temple in order to get to the maid. And in some circles, that's called prostitution. So, anyway, he's back, and we, you know, I'm still in some horror. I'm really nosediving now. And I agreed to have brunch with him. And the morning I agreed to have brunch was sort of a sacred morning in my life. I'd had a girlfriend staying with me overnight. She left. I fixed myself a jug of vodka and orange juice. And I poured myself a tumbler full. And I drank it. And as that first thing went down into my empty stomach, I remember clearly looking at the glass and holding it out in wonder and saying, "Good God, this is a morning drink. I am drinking in the morning. How amazing." And the Chinese saying, there's an ancient Chinese saying, aren't they all ancient? But I mean, that says, the beginning of wisdom is to call something by its correct name. And, you know, I'd had a drink in the morning many, many times, but I'd called it brunch, I'd called it a gallery opening, I called it summertime, Wednesday afternoon, or toasting the bride, whatever. I had lived in Spain for a short while, and I had cognac in my coffee every morning, and I called it Continental. I never called it drinking in the morning, but this particular morning, I named it. And then the disease, you know, comes running like one of those little birds on the sand beach, and it says, "Oh, Lorna, you know, the sort of woman you are, the kind of mind you have, just, you know, your intelligence and just the you of being you. You know, why do you make life so difficult for yourself? Why don't you give yourself a little help? And why don't you do this every morning? It would be so helpful to go to work with a little lining of courage in your stomach. You don't need to be drunk, you just need a little help." So I looked at the glass and I thought, you know, you're absolutely right, I should do this, this is ridiculous. Why do I always have to make things so difficult? Anyway, I'm having lunch with the lover and I get into the shower and I cannot release the glass from my hand. I physically cannot put it down and I'm washing myself, trying to keep the glass out of the spray. I had lunch with the lover. It was god awful. I drank more. I'd finished this carafe. I drank more, and I ended up on the steps of the Metropolitan Museum of Art by myself. And I don't know if any of you have ever been to New York and seen that. It's a very big, majestic-looking building and a huge flight of steps going up. And in the summertime, there's always loads of people sitting on those steps. And, you know, there's tourists and families and just masses of people going in and out of the museum. And it was summertime. It was August. It was just fabulous, fabulous summer Sunday in New York. And I could see that all of life was going on around me, and I couldn't get to it. I just couldn't touch it. And I remember standing up, and I've never felt so lonely in all my life as I did at that very moment. I was 30 years old. I had no one to call, no one to go to. I was so isolated. Now, I have felt lonelier than that in sobriety. All the terrible things I felt drinking, I felt far worse in sobriety. But up until that point, I guess I'd always done something to disguise those feelings. So I'd never felt it in its rawness. And I don't know if you've ever been with someone or yourself have ever received dreadful news. And there's that moment where you just don't know what to do with yourself. Shall I turn left? Shall I turn right? Shall I fix my hair? Shall I change my clothes? What shall I do? And it was like that. And I stood at the bottom of those steps of the Metropolitan, and I didn't know what to do. And a voice said, go to an AA meeting. And I went to this meeting at the Moravian Church on 31st Street and Lexington Avenue in New York. And I sat down, and now I'm pretty drunk, but I'm not drunk. I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. That was my day. I'd had a lot to drink. And I shared this morning in a meeting about angels, because I didn't know whether, I thought maybe this was an angel. It never occurred to me that it might have been up until this morning. A woman was sharing, qualifying, and to me she looked like an old hag. She was older, much older than me, and had broken capillaries on her face, and she looked very used. And she was telling my story up to where I was at that very moment. And then she went on for another 15 years. And I've often tried, very shortly after I came into the program, I hunted for that woman, and I could never find her again. And, you know, I remember saying to myself, oh my God, she's me and I'm her. And it was like I was looking at coming attractions. You know, I just knew that it was, that's what it, I was going to end up like. I just knew. And that it wasn't that far away. You know, when you're 17 or something, you know, 27 looks a long way away. And then when you're 30, say 60, looks like very far away. But it comes rushing at you so fast. And I realized that my age came rushing at me at that moment, and that there was really no difference between us. It was just a matter of time, and the time was going to pass very fast. And I've said to myself over and over and over again in that meeting, oh my God, I drink. It's drinking. I drink. It's not the husband. It's not the lover. It's not the country. It's not the parents. It's not the job. It's not my weight. I drink. It's drinking. And I was saying it over and over again. And I think that the gates opened up of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I shot through, and I was through in AA. I identified, I was here, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the idea was so frightening and so dreadful to me that I rushed out of that meeting, ran into the nearest bar, and knocked back another one. And I went drinking all that night, and then the following day I went to a meeting. And I walked in and I said, I'm here for myself. And, you know, it's like in any new experience, it took me a long time to understand the language and to understand, you know, first of all, the progress of my sobriety. I would say it took me 2 years easily of sobriety to realize I had alcoholism. You know, for a long time I thought, you know, one of the traditions is the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I didn't really have a desire to stop drinking. I was so fascinated with you and wanted to be with you and was glad that I was here, and I realized I drank, but I didn't really have a desire to stop drinking. I couldn't really see that how it was really affecting my life in a negative way. I just thought I'd gone through a bad patch. The fact that that patch had lasted since I was 4 seemed to elude me, do you know? But I didn't really have this desire to stop drinking. It was you that had the desire for me to stop drinking long before I had it. And it was your desire that buoyed me up. And, you know, for a long time I felt that I had, yes, I could see that I had tendencies towards alcoholism, and that if I didn't watch it, I could develop a really bad problem. But I had nipped it in the bud, and I had come in here before it got really bad. That I really hadn't had, you know, a lot of things that had happened to a lot of people. And you know, for a long time, I used the fateful words of, my disease says this, and my disease says that, and, you know, all that stuff. And it's fatal for me to talk about my disease, because if I keep talking like that, eventually I'll have this designer sort of disease, and then I will have a designer, then I'll start working my program, and then I'll have a designer kind of program, and you know, it'll be, well, maybe you don't have to check and see what the chicken's cooked in, and you don't really have to check out the dessert. You don't really have to be that fussy about it. And maybe a non-alcoholic beer is all right. I mean, it says non-alcoholic on the outside, after all. And after all, the president drinks non-alcoholic beer, so why shouldn't I? So, I'm sorry, ladies, I just couldn't help it. Anyway, I have to be very careful. And, you know, with that first 2 years, I realized I do not have my disease. I have the disease of alcoholism. And anything any alcoholic has ever done under the influence of alcohol, I'm capable of doing. Whether it's from child molesting, murder, suicide, whatever, gossip, I'm capable of doing. And so I can't say, oh, I would never do that, because I'm not that sort of an alcoholic. Yes, I am. I am any sort of an alcoholic. Once I've taken alcohol into my system, I'm like a marble on a plate. Any way you tip it, that's the way I roll. And I think I'm in control. So I can't have my program. I have to have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it all has to apply to me. And, you know, when I first came in the program, I thought you took one look at me and you whispered among yourselves and nudged each other and you said, thank God Lorna has arrived, because now we can hold our heads up high. We don't have to be quite so anonymous, because she gives us great credence and weight and you know, we can be proud of ourselves. Meanwhile, you know, you were patting me on the back, you know how you do, and you were saying, you keep coming back, you're in the right place. And I didn't know what it was about me that betrayed that I was new. And maybe it was the fact that I'd been wearing the same dress for the last 3 months. I had other outfits, but I just couldn't be bothered to change. I was festooned with jewelry. I had jewelry on all over the place. And this is 1976, so it was a long time before piercing and multiple rings and ear things came out. And I had gobs and gobs of makeup on. And I couldn't be bothered to take it off every night. It was just too much. So I just slathered more on every morning like Elizabeth I, and I wondered how you knew I was new. So, and I often say, you know, I'm so thrilled that I came into AA before the fashion of tattooing and piercing came out, because I'm sure I would have had the Last Supper put on my chest or something. You know. So, but anyway, now I'm in AA, and I have a sponsor. I got a sponsor. And I always like to say this, because I wasn't in touch with my drinking, I could not get in touch with the fact that I drank, like you, that it was a real big problem for me, just the same. Actually, how I got my sponsor is I was at a meeting, and I was sitting in the front row, and you know the speaker spoke, and it was a raised hand meeting, and you know how you're supposed to wait and have someone call on you. Well, someone called on me, and I shared that I didn't have this problem like the rest of you. You know, I didn't really need the program as much as the rest of you. And this woman from the back row shot out of her chair and started yelling at me. And she said, you in the front row, she said, you need this program just like the rest of us, honey, because you're going to die just like the rest of us. And I thought, ooh, you know, anyway, I asked her to be my sponsor. So, but the one thing, she never told me that I had to work this step, or I had to work that step, or I had to get in touch with my drinking story. She said she knew to lure me in. And she said to me, Lorna, if you stay with us and do as we suggest, you will be able to develop a life that will be like having a quiver of golden arrows on your back. And when you come into a situation in life that you're not too sure how to handle, you'll be able to reach back, select the perfect arrow, put it in your bow, and hit bullseye every time. And that whole concept of being appropriate in the world was so fantastic to me. You know, I was never appropriate. I was always, you know, I mean, I was the sort that wore plunging necklines to funerals and things, you know, or I laughed too loudly. I was just inappropriate. I was just wrong. I was like a jagged scream in the world. I was just never refined, or, you know, I wanted so much to be that way, but I just didn't get it right. You know, I went into Max's the years that Minnie's came out, or the other way around, or something. I was always wrong. And this whole idea of being correct was so fabulous. That's the thing that lured me in. And, you know, I've spoken for almost 45 minutes now, so I want to get on with and talk about some other things that have gone on in my life. But you know, I want to say that alcohol, and it's one thing I often forget to say, that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't given me a thing. And it's impossible for it to give us anything. You know, we often go into the language of saying, you know, I'm so grateful to AA because AA's given me blah, blah, blah. But the truth is, it can't give us anything. Because if Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program, if it could give me something, it would mean that I was incomplete to start with. That's not been my experience. My experience is that Alcoholics Anonymous, you, has allowed me to let go of what I no longer need. It's been a constant process of stripping down. You know, when I came in the program, I said, but you don't understand, I'm in the art business and I go to gallery openings and I have to drink and after all it's da da da. And they said, oh yes, well, that's very interesting, Lorna. But when we're in those situations, this is what we do. And you let me see how I could let go. I didn't have to drink and drug. I didn't have to do all that sort of stuff. And then you said to me, you know, you don't have to be angry, but you don't understand when I'm at the checkout counter or when I'm in the bank, they are very irritating, those people. And my mother, and you said, oh yes, we can see that that is very upsetting. This is what we do in those situations. And you let me let go of this thing. You know, I had this very big loser phrase. This is the big loser phrase. That's just the way I am. That's the way I always do things. And as soon as I've said that, I've made my life about this big and this narrow. And, you know, it's not the way I am. I don't want to be that way. And you're showing me another way to be. And so Alcoholics Anonymous has been a process for me of letting the beauty and the individual thing of what God created coming about. And the thing that's been my biggest burden has been my personality. And to just sort of let go of mindsets and ways I think of things and how to be. And, you know, it's when we are given this great gift, it's also attendant with it is a huge thing of claiming. And I just want to share a couple of stories of standing by that which I believe. When I was very shortly sober, not very long, I think I was in my first year, I was asked to do a charity auction at the Plaza Hotel in New York for this very big charity. And it was $1,000 a plate dinner. So all the swells were there. And I'm there in the, I forget what that room is called, the Golden Room or something like that, in the big ballroom at the Plaza Hotel. And there's hundreds of people there for this dinner. And I'm the auctioneer, and they start this auction. I could not, and I'm all done up again in a ball gown, and I could not control this room. I could not make them keep quiet. They would not settle down and keep quiet. And I was getting more and more and more upset. And suddenly I realized, oh my God, I'm going to have to drink in order to perform this auction. I'm going to have a vodka and orange juice to get through this. And suddenly I saw all your faces, all the people that had helped me, all the meetings that I'd gone to, all the promise of my sponsor, all the freshness of the new road I was on that I didn't quite understand, but I knew it was a different path. And I turned the microphone up very loudly and I said, ladies and gentlemen, I can no longer afford to be here. And I grabbed my shawl and I walked straight out of this ballroom to the crowd, and they're like, and you could have heard a pin drop. And I knew I was going to lose my job. I knew my boss was going to break my gavel over his knee, and that was going to be the end of it. And I just walked out, and I ran home, and I put on a fleecy nightie, and I got into bed, and I said, oh, my sponsor said that if I put my head on the pillow at night and I haven't had a drink, I'm a great success. I'm a great success. I'm like, oh, I've lost my job. I'm a great success. You know, I just want to say this to you. Those 400 people are not still sitting at the Plaza Hotel waiting for me. You know, life has gone on. They just muddled through. They got through it somehow. And some of you in this room know that I was very, very friendly with Mother Teresa. And I've been in India many times and worked with the missionaries of charity, and she and I were close. Anyway, one time she was really ill. This is back in the mid-90s. And I rushed off to Calcutta to be with her, and they took me straight from the airport to her hospital room. And I get into this room. A mother knew I was in the program, and she was fascinated with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just want to say, no, I'll tell you that in a minute. But I got in the hospital room. Is a very tiny room, and mother's in bed, propped up on some pillows, looking quite ill, and then a young priest comes in to say mass, and they set that table up, you know, the one that wheels up to the patient they could eat up. They set it up at the foot of her bed so they could say mass. So the priest is standing at the foot of the bed, saying mass, facing mother. I'm standing on this side of her, and there's another nun standing next to me, and two more sisters on the other side. And he offers mass. And then time comes for communion. He comes around the side of the bed, I sort of squished to the side, and he dips the host in the chalice of wine, and he gives it to mother. And mother pushes herself up to take the communion, and I thought to myself, oh my God, no, not here. Don't let me have to make a fuss here with this, you know, saint of the world dying in bed next to me. For God's sakes, don't bring all the attention onto yourself, Lorna. Just let it pass this one time. It's the sacred blood of Jesus. You know, just let it be. It doesn't matter. You don't have to count your days again. It's fine. So, and then again, I thought of all of you, and I thought of the covenant I have made, that I will not take alcohol in any way, shape, or form into my system. And I need help doing that. No matter, and mother always said, the devil can come to you disguised as an angel of light and fool you with your eyes wide open. And here I was with my eyes wide open, receiving the body and blood of Jesus. And here it's coming closer to me. And AA would have just been, and I suddenly said, no, 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 no wine. I mean, I didn't know how to say no sacred blood or whatever you're supposed to say, you know. And he gave the host to the sister standing next to me, and then he gave me a simple host. But then he went around the other side of the bed. And I was really shaken by this. You know, I was really, I disturbed mother's devotions. I'd put all the attention onto myself in this very sacred, powerful moment. And while he was on the other side of the bed, mother's hand came across the covers, and she squeezed mine, and she said, well done. You must continue to protect your precious gift. And you know, I want to tell you that I'm sure most of you in the room have heard of Mother Teresa, and she was considered to be a fabulous woman and a great saint and a very highly evolved spiritually. And in the Mother House in Calcutta, there's a big statue of the Virgin Mary on one side of the altar. And under that statue, Mother would put things that were important to her in any time, like when she won the Nobel Prize, that was put under the statue for a while. And I noticed when I was there, and several times I've been there, that pride of place under that statue was our little laminated card with the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and the Serenity Prayer. And you know, Mother had success with every form of suffering human, but she could not help the alcoholic, because she didn't have the words of everlasting life that you and I have. She didn't know how to say, I know how you feel. Let me tell you what happened to me. So you and I have this phenomenal, phenomenal, rare, unusual privilege of being able to share with another alcoholic. And you know, time is really going on, but I just want to say that there's a few more stories, and I just want to talk about what's happened to me in this last week. But you know, mother died in 97, and Aaron very kindly gave the commercial. You know, I finished this book, which is a spiritual biography, and it was very much to do with my relationship with mother. And I distributed the book word of mouth only, so I never knew where it was going to end up. And one time I got a letter from a woman that was a hermit in Christ in the Desert Monastery in Abiquiú, New Mexico, and she'd gotten a hold of my book, and she wrote to me, and then she invited me to go and stay with her for a bit. And I mean, how often does one get an invitation from a hermit? You know, of course I went off to the desert and I spent time with her, and it was just a fabulous experience. And when I came back, I received a phone call actually from the Missionaries of Charity asking me if I would submit copies of all my correspondence from Mother Teresa for the cause of Mother's canonization. They were looking into her cause for sainthood. So I submitted copies of all my letters from her, and I wrote to the hermit and I said, you know, this is what's happened. Isn't that nice that I've been asked to do this? And she wrote back and she said, I'm praying that you get called as a witness for Mother's canonization. And I thought to myself, poor old dear, she's been out in the desert a bit too long. You know, the sun's really gotten to her. Mother and I were close, but that's a whole different level. But lo and behold, a couple of months later, I came home, and in my mailbox was an envelope from the Metropolitan Tribunal asking me if I would present myself and, you know, give a testimony for this servant of God, Mother Teresa of Calcutta. And so I did that. And this time last year, I was in Rome for that ceremony. And you know, if you had asked me when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, what's your wildest dream? I can assure you, I would not have said, well, I'd like to help some little old lady become a saint one day, you know? My wildest dreams were money, men, and mansions. And I realize now that it really is beyond my wildest dreams. You know, it's really, in my epilogue I wrote that thing that it's, that I realize now, and it's taken me a long time, it doesn't have to take you this long, that beyond my wildest dreams means beyond, completely beyond, in a different level, a different dimension. And the wild dreams that are fulfilled in Alcoholics Anonymous are always about the other. It's never just about self. It's always a blessing for all. And, you know, the fact that I can finally say, this is beyond my wildest dreams, that I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I am a witness to a saint. I mean, that I was called in this, and up until this week, this was the most phenomenal thing that had happened to me. And I'm going to have to leave the meeting on a little note, but also a little joyful. And I don't want to go into lots of details about it, and I hope that a lot of you, you know, won't come up and in a curious way ask me a lot of details, but some of you in the room I've shared with and know what happened. But I want to tell a story. This past Tuesday night, I was asked by a young man in Texas to witness his execution. So I was, this past Tuesday, I was in Huntsville watching this diabolical procedure, and and he died very beautifully, and I really felt that I was at the foot of the cross. I was with a young man who was being executed by the state, and I was able to be there. He'd asked me to be his spiritual advisor. Anyway, in the morning, he was at he was at the prison in Livingston, Texas. And we were all able, those of us that were witnesses and other friends and relatives, were able to go there in the morning and visit with him. And then at noon he was taken to Huntsville, and the execution was at 8 o'clock in the evening. But and then we all went off to Huntsville. But in the morning, we were there visiting, and in that room also, we had to speak to him. He was behind a glass thing, and we spoke through telephones. His mother was there in the morning, and his eye had a about the mother. She'd been extremely abusive to him as a youngster, extremely. But she was also from a house and was terribly abused. But even so, here's Dominique, and he's about to die, and the mother is sitting there, and it's the first time I'd ever met her. And I could hardly bring myself to say hello to her. And I did not have a great feeling of sympathy or connectedness to this woman, because my concentration was on him, and he and she had had a very difficult relationship, very difficult. And he'd been kicked out of home when he was 15, and it was just a horror story. Anyway, we're all there, and then it comes to the end, and we all say goodbye, and she is talking to her son on the telephone, and they had some kind of reconciliation, and they'd been visiting with each other over the last few days. But, and you know, whatever went on between them was none of my business. And we're leaving the prison, we're going out, and she's in the parking lot. And the one thing I knew about her, someone had told me that she was in recovery 120 days. And I went up to her and I said to her, I hadn't really spoken, I'd sort of inclined my head. I hadn't introduced myself, I'd been very rude. And she knew who I was, she knew that I was called as a witness. He didn't ask her to be a witness, he was allowed five people there. And I went up to her and I said, look, I said, I know that you're in recovery 120 days. She said, yes. I said, I am too. And then I went on to talk to her, and I said to her, if you feel like drinking and drugging, there is nothing a drink or a drug is going to do to make this situation any better. It's going to be more hideous for you if you do. It's going to be more hideous for us all. I said, but you and I have a special thing. We're called to something very high, and we're called to something very profound. And if you and I stay sober through this, we can lift this whole situation up. And I said to her, you know, you might, if you stay sober, you will have regrets about your relationship with Dominique, and you'll be going through the steps, and you'll have some things that you might be overwhelming to you, but I can assure you, if you stay with us on this path, you will be able to correct that relationship. You will be able to have a healing with that relationship. I promise, I promise, I promise you. And however terrible you're feeling now, you'll be able to turn that around to see the wonder of it all and the gift that he's given to us. Now, I've got to tell you, I never say this in a meeting like this, but I am very proud of the fact of what I did there, overcoming my feelings. And I want to tell you, AA triumphed. AA triumphed. It was about this fellow's going off to be executed, but the main thing was the mother and me. And you know, maybe I couldn't save him, but maybe I could give her words of everlasting life. And you know, I said to her, this can be a real crossroads in your life of Dominique, and you never have to go back there again. You never have to be that woman again that was his mother. You just never have to do that. And I could see the light sort of coming in her face and some measure of hope coming. I'm sure it got swamped later on in the day, but it didn't matter. And, you know, that's not me that can be that, that can transcend my anger and my irritation and my resentment. I loved this young boy, and he was very unusual and very powerful. And, you know, a lot of us said if he hadn't had this background with this crazy mother, he wouldn't be in here now. But, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous helped me and all of us transcend that. So it was just a phenomenal moment in my life. And whenever I go nosediving about Dominique, I can think about his mother in that parking lot. You know, I can think about the fact that God gave me the chance to do what really is my primary purpose. My primary purpose, whether I'm at a gala, an execution, or a play, or lazing on the beach, my primary purpose is to help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. That is my primary purpose. And, you know, I also want to take the time to share this one story so that I don't leave it quite on that. I was in New York on 9/11, and on September the 12th, I was at a meeting in the morning, and there were loads of us there. And you can imagine what was going on in that room. It was a big circle, and the pain and the tears, and people were holding photographs and wanting to know if people were still lost then. And it was terrible, and each person that shared was going through some horror. And they'd seen people jumping out of the buildings and awful. And I had felt very inadequate when those buildings went down because I didn't know how to help. I'm an auctioneer, and I knew they needed an auctioneer like a hole in the head at Ground Zero. You know, what could I give to offer? I was feeling very like, what can I do to help? And as it went around the room, with all this pain and suffering going on, there was a young girl, and she put her hand up and she said, my name's, I don't know what it was, Sally or something. She said, I'm an alcoholic. She said, and I'm having terrible problems with my relationship. And we all looked at her like, oh my God, you know, these twin towers have come down, 3,000 people have died or missing, and you're talking about your relationship? And then I suddenly realized my heart went out to her. I thought, you know, here's this woman under the rubble and the beams of the disease. As you know, she's so involved with self, like I was saying goodbye to my father, so involved with her own little world that she hasn't noticed the biggest event ever happened in American history has just happened. These are her tall ships that she's just totally missed. It's come nigh her dwelling place. And I just felt for her so much. And I thought, this is who I rescue. This is who I help. This is who I've been given. These are my people. And this is my primary purpose. So I want to thank you all for going to meetings. I want to thank you all for doing service, for passing the basket, for never letting the basket pass by without contributing something, for doing all that you do, for opening the meetings, for organizing fabulous weekends like this. Because if you weren't here and going to meetings, you know, I don't know that I would have died because I was quite healthy, but I know that my life would be a continuance of the steps of the Metropolitan, empty, bleak, and uninvolved. So thank you so much for your sobriety. Thank you.